From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The Library of Congress, that monumental vault of American culture, raised a flag again this month for the American province of sound. That's right, audio. The library announced a list of 50 sound recordings, from the scratchy inaugural of Calvin Coolidge to the cool howl of Gil Scott Heron, that helped capture the cultural orchestra of American history, it hopes, forever. The old Lake Michigan foghorn of Kewaunee, Wisconsin, is bellowing its way into the collection. Bob Hope is entertaining the World War II troops. The 1980s Sonic Youth is warping ecstatically the sound of guitar. When you listen back to some of these sounds, which we're going to do this hour, whole eras of American life come to life. This hour On Point, sorting through the 50 latest recordings from American history that the Library of Congress is determined to save. You can join the conversation. What do we save when we save the sound of American life? And how would you judge what sound needs, deserves to be saved? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington are two of the people who have marshaled this new roundup of recorded sound into the Library of Congress. Jean Anna is the head of the recorded sound section at the library. He began his career there as a playback technician back in 1981. Jean, thanks very much for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me. Great to be here.
It's good to have you. And Sam Berlosky is the former head until 2005 of the recorded sound section at the Library of Congress. He's now editor of the encyclopedic discography of RCA Victor recordings, all 150,000 of them, for the University of California at Santa Barbara. Sam, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having us.
And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, with a fine pair of ears for the sound of American history, is On Point news analyst and senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly, Jack Beatty. Jack, good to have you.
Hello, Tom. Hello to our guests.
Hello.
Hello, hello all around. Gene, remind us what that was under the intro, just as we read in here. Americans of a certain age and era will remember that, but not everybody. What was that crazy Bach?
I'm sorry, what was the question? I didn't hear.
The music behind the intro that we just heard there. I think that was from Windy Carlos, right?
Oh, that was the switched on Bach. Oh, yeah, I remember that. That was that's fantastic use of the Moog synthesizer that really changed electronic music forever.
How do you decide, Gene, what goes, and you've been doing this for a few years now, how do you decide what goes into the box of sound that's going to be preserved?
Well, it's a very intricate process. We take ballots from the public, and we have a national recording board of experts in many fields of music and the music industry, and we get their input. And we meet actually with the librarian several times and review all of the nominations and very carefully make a decision.
How long has this been going on, Sam? You were in charge of this operation not long ago. What got this launched, and how much have you saved already?
Well, the project itself is 4 years old, or at least this is the fourth year of it. It was Congress passed the National Recording Preservation Act in November of 2000 and asked the Librarian of Congress to annually select a registry of important recordings, culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant. And, I mean, I have to say the library long had a preservation program for audio since the 1950s, but this is a particular group of recordings that Congress asked the Librarian of Congress to name each year.
And so you get a kind of Hall of Fame here for sound, and it's really terrific. We want to hear a lot of it this hour. Let's dive right in. All the way back in 1917, one of this year's 50 is Nora Bay's singing Over There. There she is, 1917. Sam, why this song this year?
Well, I don't know about this year. It was a nomination. The board recommended it strongly. It's an important recording because Nora Bayes was a big star of vaudeville, not particularly well-known now, but one of the first real great female stars of the phonograph. Her name was, I think, originally Dora Goldberg, and she's most famous for the recordings with her husband, Jack Norworth, Shine on Harvest Moon, things like that.
She was in the Ziegfeld Follies, and here she is whipping up support for the American war effort. Jack Beatty, does it bring the sound of history, the texture of history back to you?
It brings my father's voice back to me. My father was a veteran of the war. His ship was torpedoed and had a terrible time at sea. And he was in London on leave, and he went into a bar, and some Brits there said, "The Yanks are coming. Well, you're 40 years late." And the big brawl would broke out. And he also told me of the sound of the Zeppelin coming over, the German Zeppelin coming over London, and it would be the sound of that motor. And then through the streets, a Cockney Bobby on bicycle yelling, "Tyke cover! Tyke cover!"
And pretty soon it's all back, and there's the soundtrack right behind it. Jack, it still brings back those funny uniforms and funny hats for me. I mean, not funny at the time, but history marches when you hear it.
Oh, it really does. And that was a stirring song. I mean, that whole bond sales and the war, those were a huge public effort. And stars and musicians and vaudeville performers got behind it. And it was a way in which the public got involved in the war. Of course, this is now our first war in which the public basically is told to go to Disneyland.
Different time, different era. Let's go back, not to the war, but just shortly after, 1920, part one of this year's 50 to be preserved is Mamie Smith singing Crazy Blues. Now, this was the first black vocalist to make a commercial vaudeville blues record. It was a surprise hit, sold more than 250,000 copies in 1920. Let's listen. Sam Berlosky, it's hard to imagine or remember now, but there was a time when black blues and jazz were not in everybody's ears. This record kind of set off an avalanche.
Absolutely, and a business avalanche. It alerted the companies that there was this untapped market, and that's to our great benefit. In other words, by discovering that market of minority record buyers, you know, thousands of recordings and thousands of pieces of music that might not have been preserved for us to enjoy now were recorded and sold a great deal, made a lot of money for the companies.
Amazing to think of that as the very first that was put down and recorded. There's a lot of music in this lineup, but you have important moments, political and otherwise, as well. Gene, I wonder if you can tell us about the sound of Calvin Coolidge here from the inauguration 1925. Why this one? I suppose every inauguralism is important, but as you know, this was particularly important.
Yeah, it was the first presidential inauguration to be broadcast, actually, and it really predates even the formal radio network, so it was a tremendous technical achievement. Amazingly, the press of the day reported that 25 million Americans tuned into that speech, which is absolutely astounding for that time. And if you think about Silent Cal addressing 25 million Americans, it's kind of ironic.
And it would have been the first time that most Americans had heard an inaugural or heard a president's voice at all.
No, he's not the first president to be recorded, but the first inaugural to be broadcast and recorded, yes.
Let's go back to 1925, the inauguration of Silent Calvin Coolidge as president.
My countrymen, no one can contemplate current conditions without finding much that is satisfying, and still more that is encouraging. Our country is leading the world in the general readjustment to the results of the great conflict. Many of its burdens will bear heavily upon us for years.
Jack, there it is, 47 minutes. We just hear a little bit of it, but there's Calvin Coolidge speaking. 1925, still to the great conflict, the war resonating half a decade later very clearly in that inaugural.
Yes, and the issues of the war would bedevil his presidency. Herbert Hoover, who's Secretary of Commerce, appealed to him to really lay off on the reparations. You know, we were essentially requiring the Europeans to pay us the money we'd loan them. And he replied, they rented the money, didn't they? And, you know, if I could hear one bit of Coolidge, it would be, I mean, Coolidge was very witty in a cutting way. And the famous story is he was at a White House table and a woman said, Mr. President, I bet someone that I could get you to say more than two words. And he looked at her and he said, you lose.
Silent Cal, cutting straight through. There's a lot more that we're going to hear in this hour from the 50 new bits of American sound that have been gathered up this year by the Library of Congress. We're going to go out of this segment listening to a 1938 recording of the NBC Symphony playing Adagio for Strings by Samuel Barber. And when we get to it, Sam Brolowski, this is a piece of music many Americans know very well from the screen and from tragic events in this country's history. This, I believe, Sam, was played at the time of JFK's death very prominently.
Yeah, I believe so. And it is one that sort of taut harmony, those close 20th century music influence harmonies, you know, represent sort of angst and anxiety, yet it's a gorgeous piece that, as you hear, sort of blooms.
This is with Arturo Toscanini leading the orchestra. It was adapted by for orchestra by Samuel Barber from a movement of his 1936 string quartet number 1, Opus 11. We know it well. Gene DeAnna, Sam Brolowski, both been involved with the Library of Congress Saving American Sound. We're going to hear a lot more of it, and you can join us. 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the sounds of America that will be saved. The latest recordings from American history headed into the Library of Congress National Recording Registry. We're joined by Gene DeAnna. He's head of the Recorded Sound Section at the Library of Congress, and by his predecessor in that role, Sam Brolowski, both joining us from Washington. Jack Beatty's with us as well. You can join us. What do we save when we save the sound of American life? And what sound, an event, music, a speech, a ringtone, would you nominate to be permanently saved? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Here from 1926 is Paolo Humeniuk with Dance Under the Willows. This is a Ukrainian violin solo. It's got cymbali bass and sleigh bells. Renowned violin player in the Ukrainian community, kicking off an era of ethnic music in the United States. Let's listen. Sam Brolowski, here we have again the sound of Americans, ethnic Americans in this case, emerging into the American mainstream, raising their voice in effect through a recording like this.
Oh, absolutely. But ironically, here's this, it's with Ukrainian music, and America not only gave these immigrants, you know, economic opportunities, but opportunities they wouldn't have had in the old world to preserve their music. You know, I don't know anything really about the Ukrainian record industry, but it was really probably for most of these immigrants who made ethnic recordings, it was only being in America that gave them that opportunity.
I love the range of things that's in here. There's a tremendous story from a recording in 1938 that you've picked this year. The announcer is giving us the Joe Louis-Max Schmeling fight. Gene DeAnna, can you remind us of the story behind this fight? And then we'll listen. It's quite a broadcast. But tell us, set it up for us, if you would, Gene.
Well, you couldn't script anything better. Here you had the African-American U.S. champ fighting a representative of Nazi Germany. And, of course, with segregation being such a big issue for the African-American community, Joe Louis represented so much to them and their stake in the war as well.
And for all Americans, a kind of an American fighter up against Germany at a time when Hitler was rising.
Absolutely. It really became a microcosm of the war.
And an incredible 124-second match, very short. As I recall, it was the first time that a heavyweight match of that type had been won in a single round. Let's listen. 1938, this is June 22nd, Joe Louis fighting Max Schmeling of Hitler's Germany. Clem McCarthy's the announcer.
Then cracked him with two straight lefts to the face and brought over that hard right to the head, high on the temple. And Max tied him up in a clinch and broke ground. His back against the ropes again there, not too close to the ropes. Louis out, and Louis missed with a left swing, but in close, brought up a hard right overcut and a right to the jaw. And again, a right to the body, a left hook, a right to the head, a left to the head, a right. Schmeling is going down. But he held to his feet, held to the rope. Look to his corner in helplessness, and Schmeling is down. Schmeling is down. The count is four. And he's up, and Louis right and left to the head, a left to the jaw, a right to the head, and Donovan is watching carefully. Louis measures him, right to the body, a left hook to the jaw, and Schmeling is down. The count is five, six, seven, eight, the men are in the ring. The fight is over on a technical knockout. Max Schmeling is beaten in one round. The first time that a world's heavyweight championship ever changed hands in one round.
Joe Louis, Max Schmeling, the fight. Unbelievable.
Yeah.
The hair
are
up on the back of one's neck listening to that. My gosh, Jackie, the sound of history right there. And Schmeling is down.
Down indeed. And I'm looking from David Margalek's wonderful book on this. I'm looking at a cartoon he reproduces from the New Masses right after it, which was a sort of popular front journal, right after the fight. And it shows Schmeling coming into Hitler's office. And Goebbels is at the door, and he's putting his finger up to his nose saying, shh. Schmeling is all bandaged up. And there in the foreground is a disconsolate Hitler picking up a book called Theory of Aryan Supremacy.
Well, Sam Brolowski, I mean, to me, that brings that fight home like no HBO video really could. The audio is so compelling.
Absolutely. And the wonderful thing about these sports broadcasts is that you can not only relive the excitement of this event, but here these masters of oral description, these men, I don't think there were women then, who were able to present a ball game. You know, there's a famous story of Ronald Reagan, who was announcing ball games and lost contact with the game and faked it for about 20 minutes. You know, he used to get ticker tapes of the ball game of what was going on and then provided, you know, all this color to it. And these people did this almost alone without the enormous resources that are behind sports broadcasts today.
And boxing at this time was more than, I mean, it wasn't the marginal sort of, you know, some disreputable sport it's turned into now, particularly in the heavyweight divisions. It was the Super Bowl, this kind of a fight. It was a big, big deal.
70 million people listening to this. And we should say, in fairness, that though he sort of stood for Hitler in this fight, Schmeling himself was not a Nazi. Sam, you remind us that later in his life, he actually supported Joe Louis financially.
Yeah, Joe Louis hit hard times, and Schmeling helped him out. He was a very decent man.
Let's get a little sound of Fanny Brice in our ears. Barbara Streisand made her famous in the movies, but if we go way back, here she is.
Whatever my man is, I am his forevermore.
Fanny Bryce from 1921 with My Man, one of the 50 recordings named to the 2005 National Recording Registry. And I should say, by the way, that if you'd like to nominate some sound for the registry to be preserved in the Library of Congress, there's a link to exactly where you can do that at our website, onpointradio.org. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Darren's calling from Watertown, Massachusetts. Hi, Darren. You're on the air.
How are you?
Very well. What do you hear, Darren? What do you think?
Well, I had a question about how extensive the archiving is outside of this special collection of 50, because I noticed a fair number of those are sort of commercially viable, in fact, reissued, like Sonic Youth or Hendrix or even the Wendy Carlos.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, there's thousands of recordings, either old LPs or things that have never been issued at all, that are risk being lost because they're not commercially viable for reissue. And so I was wondering what the Library of Congress and others are doing outside of this list of 50.
Sam, Gene, give us a sense of your archive beyond the kind of Hall of Fame 50 here. What's in there, and how well is it being preserved?
That's a great question. It's the kind of question we hope the 50 will elicit in the thinking about those other recordings that aren't on the list. I mean, I have great news to report, and that is that the library is constructing a National Audiovisual Conservation Center, and we have a collection of nearly 3 million sound recordings, as well as the moving image collections that will be housed there at Culpeper, Virginia. It should be opening within a year, and we will have an unprecedented ability to begin the real full-scale effort to start digitally reformatting our analog audio heritage, and we're very excited about it.
What's the volume of the sound archive that the Library of Congress has now? Is it the main vessel for sound preservation in this country? Sorry, Gene?
It's the largest sound archive in the world, we believe. Nearly 3 million recordings. We're acquiring in about 75,000 annually through copyright deposit, but also we're still acquiring cylinders. It's a tremendous archive.
And what are the main challenges in terms of preservation here of some of these older means of recording, going all the way right on back to wax cylinders? What lasts and what doesn't?
Yeah, well, the challenges as far as just the physical carrier deteriorating are tremendous. And there are the two formats that I think we're probably the most concerned about would be the lacquer discs, that is the instantaneous recording used by radio stations and others before tape was invented by the Germans in World War II. So that format is very, very delicate and can delaminate very easily. The other is simply any tape format. Again, if it's a magnetic recording, it could be at risk depending on how it's stored.
And I would think, Gene, that the technology for playing this stuff may also be scarce.
Certainly, and that applies to, really, it should apply to any form. And the listener asked about recordings in print, and absolutely he's right. Sonic Youth isn't an immediate danger, but it's a commercial decision. In 20 years, if Sonic Youth isn't going to sell, Sonic Youth won't be on the latest and greatest format. So these are just, you know, things to think about.
I would hope that you'd, I'm sure you have, but just to underline it, to get some of the sounds of daily life, the quintessential sounds of the eras. I mean, from the 20s, I would love to hear the sound of a crank starter for the Model T. You know, the motor would start to turn over, then it would flop on its side with a thud, then the driver would crank again, there'd be a pause while the thing hung fire, then a thin sound, the engine catching like an egg beater, and voila! I mean, just to hear that was something every American heard every day.
We've got a little bit of that in this collection, Jack. The old foghorn from Kewaunee, Wisconsin, recorded in 1972. Gene, Sam, can you give us the history on this? Why have you selected a foghorn for the collection?
Well, this was a case of evidence of one town in Wisconsin that wanted to compete with Chicago as a port and did a lot of development and built a port. And this one, you know, foghorn went out of use sometime, I think, in the 60s or 70s. And one person went out and made sure that he recorded it before it went down. I might add also that this was a public nomination to the recording registry, one that caught the imagination of the Library and the Congress, who recognized that the registry is more than, you know, as you put it, greatest commercial recordings or even historically significant recordings, but ones that sort of capture a little slice of oral history.
In this case, oral as in foghorn history. Let's listen exactly. to the old Kewaunee, Wisconsin foghorn. On it moans, and I have no doubt that anybody who grew up with that will hear a lot of years and time and aspirations in that sound. Gene, you point out that the sound of America, the kind Jack's talking about, really is changing. A heavy industry, much less evident. Highways all over the place, no more railroad, some real sort of fundamental background sounds, some rising and some falling.
Sure. If you think about the technology that's changed, the sounds of cars have changed. I mean, you can be walking down the street and hear a 60s car coming behind you. So all of these things are very transient if we don't capture them. And I should say there is a history of recording things like that. So we do have in the library, in the archive, some interesting, I guess they would be called sound effect recordings, but were made historically in the 20s and 30s, so it would be interesting to go back and look at those. It would have to be post 25 or 30 probably, but we could dig those out.
A few years ago, the National Recording Registry included a collection of steam locomotive sounds.
Yep.
Terrific, and keep them coming. Let's get the sound of a comedian many Americans will know, but maybe not from this recording. Here from 1942, one of the 50, is Bob Hope, master of ceremonies in a command performance show for the troops early on in the war. July 7th, 1942. Bob Hope, you can hear all kinds of shades of Jay Leno right here, I'd say, listening back. Let's listen.
Hey, thank you, Paul Douglas, and hiya, fellas. This is Bob Rubber Drive Hope, telling you guys out there that we're all going to keep turning in our rubber suspenders till we've caught the Axis with their panzers down. Well, everybody here is talking about the rubber drive. Back in New York, they were worried about the rubber drive for a while, but not anymore. Kate Smith finally turned in her girdle. You should see the moon come over the mountain now, but I'm not worried. But I'm not worried about the rubber shortage. I've got four new tires, and I put them all on my front wheel. I want them to be where I can watch them. But I want to tell you, this rubber situation is really serious. Last night, three fellas broke into my room at the Knickerbocker Hotel, jacked me up, and stole my hot water bottle.
It still works. Jack, I'm hearing that. It really does sound a lot like the Tonight Show in 2006. A little bit racy even for Bob Hope there.
Oh, yeah, and, you know, every time I watch the Academy Awards, I miss him. I mean, he did that so well, and he'd always do that thing with Crosby, you know, resentful that Bing had won Academy Awards where he hadn't. You know, they tell a story about Bob that his lovers were so numerous that every time women would he'd give them mink coat as a going-away present, and women would meet in a store and say, oh, so you knew Bob, too.
And there you go, the moon coming up over the mountain there. And it's interesting here, Sam, how it brings back things. I mean, sound, but also girdles. I mean, who's seen a girdle in 100 years? I don't know. We're just back in the daily minutia of life from a different time.
Yeah, nothing ruins a joke like overanalyzing it, yet, as will be the case with Jay Leno or Conan O'Brien or Jon Stewart even, you have to sort of remind people the context of topical humor before or after they hear a joke that involves topical humor.
A rubber drive because rubber was needed for the war effort to put tires on all those Jeeps.
Yeah, and the moon over the mountain was Kate Smith's theme song. And Kate Smith, by the way, was a
not to mention her fulsome
singer.
Anatomy.
Yeah, exactly. Who's Kate Smith? But
yeah, it's terrific. That was Bob Hope from a command performance. That was a wartime broadcast for the Troops American Forces Radio Service in World War II. Gene DeAnna and Sam Berlosky, Jack Beatty, please stick with us. We're listening back to Sounds of America, recorded for the National Recording Registry. These were selected for 2005. Nominations for 2006, well, you can chip in at our website, onpointradio.org. Find the link and join us. What does sound preserve that sights and smells and maybe even books do not? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Going out here with Sonic Youth. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.com. And RHR International, an executive and organizational development firm committed to integrating executives into new roles.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, listening to Sounds of America That Will Be Saved. There's Martha and the Vandellas from 1964 singing Dancing in the Street. We are listening to some of the latest recordings from American history headed in to the Library of Congress National Recording Registry. It's a kind of sound hall of fame at the Library of Congress. By no means all they're saving there, but highlights. Many of them nominated by Americans like yourself. And you can do that for the next round at onpointradio.org. You can also join this conversation. What iconic sounds are vanishing from our lives today? And what sounds from your life do you hope your great-grandchildren might hear? What do you hear in these old and not so old sounds from the National Registry? We're at 1-800-423-8255. We've been joined by Gene DeAnna and Sam Berlowski, the current and just previous heads of recorded sound, the recorded sound section at the Library of Congress. You can join us, 800-423-TALK. Tone is calling from Stowell, Massachusetts. Hi, Tony, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm curious about dialect, I guess. I've done some research in early radio, and there's a different kind of sound to the American voice. In some of the early recordings, the Fanny Bryce recording and Calvin Coolidge's, and I'm curious as to what your guests think about when that changes and why. They just, you know, they sound different to me, and it's not just the recording technology.
Sam, do you want to speak to that? I mean, no one can fail to notice that Americans speak differently in perhaps every decade, but certainly over these many decades. Do you follow it?
Well, I'm not a linguist, but there are a few things to say about it. One of them is the early recordings up to 1925 were recorded acoustically. You had to literally shout into a horn. So someone like Fanny Bryce, I mean, she's really putting over a song by, you know, performing not in front of an audience, not in front of a microphone, but, you know, really a conical horn that she's shouting into. And I'm sure that affected her style. A lot of people believe that national broadcasting, you know, starting in radio in the 1920s, had an effect on our accents. That is to say that it homogenized our sound. That might be true to some extent, but I think I have a slight Piedmont accent, if not a Southern accent, and a little of that is left. What's most remarkable is hearing certain people. The one that comes to mind to me is Theodore Roosevelt, who this very masculine persona, had a pretty high voice. And I wonder whether he could be president today with that voice. I wonder how much of the looks and the sound of candidates and leaders is affected by how they look.
Let's get a little more of a sound from a different time in our ear and not let this issue go, because it's a really wonderful one. Not a high voice here, but a low one in Orson Welles here reading Archibald MacLeish's Fall of the City. This is April 11th, 1937.
He looks tired. He winds through the crowd with his mouth open, laboring. The people are offering water. He pushes away from them. Now he has come to the stone steps, to the ministers. Stand by. We're edging in. Listen. Leaning on the stone. He's speaking.
There has come the conqueror. I am to tell you. I have run over cornland. I have climbed over coneland. I have crossed over mountains. It was laid on my shoulders by Shell and by Shant. And standing by day and staying by night were not for my lot till I came to the sight of you. Now I have come. I bear word. Beware of this conqueror.
April 11th, 1937, Orson Welles, and in this recording with Burgess Meredith and Paul Stewart, reading there from Earl McGill's production of Archibald MacLeish's Fall of the City. It's a kind of chilling vision of a not-so-future war that Welles narrated there. And, of course, war came. But once again, Jack Beatty, in that, you hear that very different diction of that time, and they're not shouting into a big recording trumpet.
No, and I think part of that goes back to the elocution lessons in school. That was a big part of the curriculum in America, right up, I guess, till Marlon Brando. And elocution, you finish what you're going to say, you make it very clear, and then in other words, there was a whole, that was part of the training that every young person, I remember my mother used to go into these orations from her elocution lessons. That's all gone now, and what's the pity?
There's a lot of history to be heard, and I guess heard in its absence. Right there, Rose is calling from Hingham, Massachusetts. Hi, Rose, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, Jack. How are you doing? I just wanted to mention that I thought an important thing to include in this would be the unedited initial tapes of when the two towers were hit on that horrible day. I can remember watching video with my friend while my one-year-old was asleep upstairs, and I don't know who had the handheld camera or what, but they were using vernacular, I'll just put it that way,
yeah.
And it was very real, and I think it... Hearing that voice, it was like the voice of America for me.
Rose, do you remember exactly what you were listening to? Was it commercial television, radio, something else?
It was commercial television. It was the initial, someone with a handheld camera. I don't know who got a hold of it. It was probably Channel 4 here in Boston, so that's what we watch for news. But it was just astonishing to me. The camera was shaking up and down. You could see the building was hit, and you could just hear them say, Jesus Christ, excuse me, and just all of the raw emotion before it was sanitized by the networks. Really, I remember it.
Yeah.
It was amazing, and I think that gives a clearer picture of where language was in the United States at that time, and the feeling, just the feeling of shock and incredulity and horror, and am I believing what I'm seeing? Could this possibly be right?
Unedited, unfiltered, and right out there. Gene DeAnna, think about that with us for a moment. Surely, one day, that will be on your list of 50 in 1 year. How do you imagine you'll decide which bit of reporting you might preserve to mark that day, 9/11/2001.
Well, I think for the audio registry, we have received at the library not what the listener described, but the radio broadcast that began immediately after the first crash into the towers, the police broadcast, emergency broadcasts, and we have many hours of those, which would be, I think, an excerpt of those would be a very appropriate. For inclusion, what the listener described, I think, would be more appropriate. It's very much a visual artifact, not only audible. So I would think you'd want to see the picture and the sound for that particular thing she described. So that'd be perfect for the moving image registry, film registry.
Tom,
yes, please. Yeah,
the first registry included the eyewitness account of the crash of the Hindenburg.
Yeah,
and I think that's a really completely, you know, I won't say the same, but this sort of just someone struck by emotion just happened to be recorded by chance.
Mm-hmm.
The most poignant and telling recordings I can think of relating to the tragedies of the World Trade Center might be the answering machines, that the recordings on those,
yeah,
from cell phones of people in airplanes or in the towers, made possible by technology that wasn't that old. And I mean, almost heart-stoppingly poignant, and something I really don't want to listen to, but something that should be preserved, and I'm sure many people are preserving them, but the families aren't quite ready to share those and shouldn't be yet.
Mm-hmm. I guess I hope they will. That seems sooner or later to merit a place in your archive. Paul's calling from Muscatine, Iowa. Hi, Paul. You're on the air.
Yes. I've been an amateur recorder for probably 40 years, and have gone through formats from reel to reel to 8-track to cassette and now to digital recording. And I'm wondering exactly what kind of storage is this going into, and what about future storage? How do we preserve these things, you know, forever, or can we?
Yeah, so what's the way, Gene?
Well, the most important thing is backup, 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 and that means having your audio on a file that is on a server system of some kind that's backed up regularly by a professional, I would say professional IT, in a professional IT environment. That's the ideal audio repository description that I'd come up with. And for your own playing and listening, you need not have the highest resolution audio. You know, probably happy with something as CD quality. But, you know, so the highest quality on a file format that you can back up and that hopefully migrate to the next platform down the road.
And if you back up, back up, back up, is there any reason that sound should not last as long as any other element in the Library of Congress?
No, there is no reason. It seems to me that the great news is that we can back up with a digital file without losing. In the analog world, you make a copy, you've lost a generation of sound quality. With digital, you should be getting a true and faithful reproduction. So that's why it's going to work, we hope.
The Library of Congress is building a sound repository for digital files, which isn't much help to civilians, those without the budget resources. But the idea is that what preservationists call LOCKS, L-O-C-K-S, lots of copies kept separately, which could just mean making a few clones of your CDRs and sending one to your in-laws across the state and keeping one in your basement, just having them separate places, and then every 5 or 10 years maybe just making another clone.
We hear it and we vote for it. We remember the great library in Alexandria, Egypt, of course, gone, and anyone can go, so make lots. Jack, we're just about out of time here. We're going to go out in a moment with Jimi Hendrix and Are You Experienced from 1967. But your thought on what sound saves for us that maybe images or even a smell, you know, olfactory sense brought back, that other things don't?
Well, I think it gives us room to imagine. I mean, all you hear is the sound, and you've got to people it. You've got to put a world around it. It's not done for you as it is visually. And I think, therefore, we participate in it more. It evokes more.
Sure does. Here's our last one. Jimi Hendrix, Are You Experienced, 1967, psychedelic rock. Just big as it gets from that time. I want to thank our guest, Gene DeAnna, at the Library of Congress, and Sam Brolowski, along at the Library of Congress, and now at the University of California at Santa Barbara. Both of you for being with us. Gene and Sam, thanks very much.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks, Tom.
And Jack, thanks for coming along.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. We go out with Jimmy. This is On Point.
And the wind cries, Mary.
A dramatic turn of events in Nepal yesterday, following 19 days of pro-democracy protests and a violent official crackdown that paralyzed the nation, King Gyanendra conceded to protesters' demands and turned the Nepali government over to the parliament, yielding powers he had seized 14 months ago. In his announcement, the king acknowledged the power of, quote, the people's movement, but he did not explicitly address demands made by Maoist rebels to redraw the nation's constitution and to let the Nepalese people decide the future of the monarchy. So Nepal remains unstable, its future uncertain. For award-winning Nepali novelist Samrat Upadhyay, that means continued suffering and hope for his beloved country.
As a youngster growing up in Nepal, I learned that the king was the most benevolent of beings, close to God Vishnu. A king whose heart bled when his people suffered. My school textbooks extolled the virtues of the one-party panchayat system and portrayed voices of dissent as unpatriotic, even treasonous. Our national anthem was filled with praises of the king, our glorious ruler, may he live forever, with scant mention of the people's aspirations. The government-owned media fed us the same symbols, the magnificent Himalayan mountains, Lord Buddha, born here, we were told ad nauseam, the fearless Gorkha soldiers, and the ever-present, ever-compassionate king. All of these became so entwined in our minds that our chests automatically swelled with pride at their mention. Sundar, Shanta, Bishal. That's what our country was. Beautiful, peaceful, majestic. Beautiful, Nepal still is. Peaceful, Nepal is not, and hasn't been for a while. Majestic? Well, we've taken care of that, haven't we? There's nothing majestic about a king who refuses to face the reality that the royal we, you know, the kind that says, we bestow upon you, our common citizens, our wishes for a full-fledged democracy, but we reserve the right to imprison you, torture you, and if it pleases us, shoot you. That royal we no longer carries currency among the Nepali people. Last week, when I called my mother in Nepal to get her opinion on all this, she hesitantly answered, well, if we're going to be a republic, I'll support it. My mother has seen enough protests in her lifetime. Street demonstrations expressing defiance against the government were frequent in Nepal even during the democratic years. My mother is also not a royalist. She's not a congressee, nor a communist, nor a progressive, nor a republican. She's only an aging mother who wants to pass her days in peace as she waits for phone calls from her far-flung children. Or take my mother-in-law, who has to worry about her Alzheimer's-ridden husband wandering into the bullet-riddled streets. These are people dear to me. There are others I can only read about. The widow of a demonstrator killed Thursday. She couldn't cremate her husband in his hometown. Instead, the police burned him at a spot of their choosing, angry that she wouldn't sign papers declaring him a terrorist. Sometimes I think the scope of human suffering is limitless. The Maoists who have beheaded villagers, journalists tortured by the government in cold, dark cells, the unimaginable pain of families whose members have simply disappeared. Nepal's immediate future is a challenging one, and I suspect cyclical. Hours after my conversation with my mother, His Majesty announced that he was granting power back to the people. I was only keeping it safe for you wretches, he suggested. But even if the king were rendered impotent, what next? Can we trust the Maoists not to go on a killing spree again? Can we count on our young leaders not to turn selfish and corrupt once they're in positions of power? How can we even begin healing our wounds? The answers to these questions won't come to us easily, not within days or even weeks or months or years. I think of the words of our own Lord Buddha, who said, I teach only suffering and the transformation of that suffering. For the sake of every Nepali's sanity, let's hope that a transformation has finally begun.
Nepali novelist Samrat Upadhya is author of Arresting God in Kathmandu and The Guru of Love. His latest collection of short stories is The Royal Ghosts. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.